Today, on this episode of the PeerDirect Special Spotlight.
But what we've learned actually is that using something called, you know, the CAM classification, we can get more granularity on understanding the layers that are lost in GA.
Today, Drs. Modi and Dadanya joined the podcast to discuss geographic atrophy, navigating the latest advances in care in this PeerDirect Specialist Spotlight. All opinions expressed are those of the presenters and do not necessarily reflect the views of this educational initiative supporters.
Hello, I'm Yash Modi. I'm an associate professor of ophthalmology. I do specialize in vitreoretinal surgery and uveitis at NYU in New York City.
And I'm Vaidhi Dadanya. I'm the program director for the Retina Fellowship and an associate professor of ophthalmology at NYU Langone Health in New York City.
Today, we'll be focusing on current state of diagnosis and treatment in geographic atrophy. Dr. Dadanya, how does that sound to you?
Sounds great, Yasha.
Can you start off with a brief overview of where we are in diagnosing geographic atrophy and the imaging modalities that you use in clinic?
So when I'm evaluating a patient in clinic for geographic atrophy, I focus on both the OCT, or the optical coherence tomography, and the FAF, or the fundus autofluorescence. And I tend to use both of these in combination to identify whether a patient has geographic atrophy or is at risk of geographic atrophy, and what I'm looking for as the next steps.
Yeah, you know, we used to use fundus autofluorescence a lot. If you remember in Derby and Oaks, as well as Gather 1 and Gather 2, this was the sort of standard to establish the efficacy of treatment in geographic atrophy because it showed progressive slowing of geographic atrophy area relative to that of sham. But what we've learned actually is that using something called, you know, the CAM classification, we can get more granularity on understanding the layers that are lost in GA. So can you talk to us a little bit about the value of looking at the ellipsoid zone in addition to the RP?
Yeah, so, looking at both of them gives us an idea of how a patient might progress over time and what their risk is. When we think about the ellipsoid zone, we actually have found that we tend to see the loss of the ellipsoid zone precede the loss of the RPE. And so when we're looking at an OCT, it identifies, or we are able to identify on that OCT, which we're looking at loss of. For example, whether we're seeing loss of the ellipsoid zone or the RPE. Then we can go ahead and look at the fundus autofluorescence. And what we see is that you can't always make the distinction on which is being lost on the fundus autofluorescence. Sometimes it may look as if a patient does not have geographic atrophy. And that's cued us in to say, well, what else is going on here? Because those patients may not have loss of RPE yet. And so that's important for us to make our assessment and our prognosis for these patients.
That's right. You know, and what's really fascinating is we always used to talk about the pattern of hyperautofluorescence that we would see as a risk factor for progression. And what we're kind of learning is that that probably just represents ellipsoid zone loss. And there's actually some really good post-hoc analysis work done by Ursula Schmidt, specifically using Derby and Oaks. And what they had identified was that the greater the rate of ellipsoid zone loss to that of RPE, that actually the more easy to RPE loss, the faster the rate of progression. And so in order to be able to use that clinically, we have to be very, very good at being able to quantify the loss of ellipsoid zone to be able to understand risk. So Vaidhi, can you give me a circumstance then where we lose the ellipsoid zone but have relative sparing of the RP?
Yeah, so we tend to see this in patients, for example, with subretinal drusenoid deposits. In those patients, we see more of a loss of the ellipsoid zone than we do of the RPE. But when we follow these patients over time, we see that all of a sudden they may actually have significant loss of the RPE, and those patients may also have more of a dramatic decline in their vision. This is kind of explainable by looking at their imaging.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, as we move forward, we are starting to see a shift away from the RPE to the ellipsoid zone. And, you know, there's a little bit of precedent for using ellipsoid zone analysis in clinical trials. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so actually this precedent was actually initially set from the CNTF studies. And these studies were actually not done in patients with macular degeneration, but rather in patients with MacTel. And this now serves as a primary endpoint in some studies. Dr. Modi, can you go into that a little bit for us?
Yeah, I mean, it's great to have this new precedent because it allows a therapeutic pathway that's different from that of the RPE. And there's a molecule called elamipretide. This really works on the mitochondria, and it's been studied as a subcutaneous delivery for geographic atrophy treatment. And interestingly, it failed its phase 2 primary endpoint when looking at the RPE. But a postdoc analysis actually looked and sort of said, hey, yes, we are in fact slowing the rate of ellipsoid zone loss. And so they've modified this in their phase 3 endpoint, actually looking at ellipsoid zone changes and not the RPE. So let's shift gears a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about treatment. There is currently pegcetacoplan, Avastin captopegol. Are these medications you're using in your clinical practice?
Yeah, I do use these medications in my clinical practice. I start off when patients come in educating them about what sort of or what type of macular degeneration that they have. And then in patients with geographic atrophy or from my imaging, I can tell are at high risk of developing geographic atrophy, I talk to them about both of these FDA-approved medications, and I explain to them the risks and what we're looking at when we think about the outcome of treatment for them. We have to really put this in perspective for these patients because it's a different goal of treatment than what we're treating our wet AMD patients for. Many of these patients come in thinking that their vision is going to get better or that we're treating them to reverse their geographic atrophy, when in fact we are treating them to slow the progression or the rate of progression of the increase in size of their geographic atrophy.
So who is your ideal patient in this situation?
So my ideal patient is a patient that has geographic atrophy extrafoveally, and patients who are having either rapid progression or noticing a decline in their vision, especially if it's in a fellow eye.
You know, one of the things that we've always focused on, just because of this is how the clinical studies were designed, is enlargement in the area of geographic atrophy. But what we know is that sometimes GA can enlarge, but doesn't move closer to the fovea. It can get quite a bit larger, and in fact, even surround the fovea. You know, there was an interesting study done at the National Eye Institute. It was a postdoc analysis of AREDS 1 and AREDS 2. They combined the data, and what they had showed was that for patients taking vitamins, this actually had a slow directionality to the fovea, but interestingly, the GA area didn't change. Now, when we look at the Derby and Oaks population, the group that is the Apellis group went back and looked at this data, and they didn't find this in their own data set. So it's kind of interesting. We have to now have two potential endpoints, one that looks at enlargement of area and the other one that looks at directionality to fovea. So when you're thinking about your clinical practice, how much does this weigh in what your decision-making to start treatment?
At this point, I utilize these two endpoints more in my discussion with the treatments we have available. I explain to patients that we're looking at a decrease in the growth rate of those lesions, but that we don't know as much about directionality.
Yeah, totally agree. And you know, one of the difficulties of these treatments is that patients require every 4 to 8 week injections in perpetuity only to slow the progression. And so this is excellent that we have first generation therapeutics, but I think there is a large unmet need. And so I think as we move forward, we're going to be looking at subcutaneous injections, oral therapies targeting complement, alternative targets as we discuss with elamipretide, gene therapy strategies, and even RP reconstitution strategies. I think it's a great time to be in retina, and it's so wonderful that we have all these potential therapeutics in the pipeline. This has been a great discussion, Vedi. Thanks for joining me today for this discussion of advances and future treatment targets for geographic atrophy.
My pleasure, Yasha. This has been great.
And thank you for joining us today.
And that's today's special spotlight. Thank you for joining us for this episode of PeerDirect Medical News Podcast. For more stories like these, visit us at peerdirect.com. Thoughts, comments, or suggestions, please leave us a review in your preferred listening platform or email us at editorial@peerdirect.com. Subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Pandora, Apple Podcasts, or TuneIn. You can also download our Amazon Alexa Flash Briefing Medical News Roundup and just ask, what's my flash briefing? Thanks today to our guests, Drs. Modi and Dadania. Join me next time for an episode where we cover the latest stories in the world of medicine.